This is Saturday with Claire Byrne. You're very welcome to the programme, and we'd like to hear from you today on any of the topics we're about to cover over the next hour. You can text us on 51551, email saturday@rte.ie, and the Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. First today, on the line from London, we're joined by Sally Mulready, who's a campaigner for the rights of women who lived in Magdalen Laundries and those who lived and gave birth in mother and baby homes. And Sally herself lived in St Patrick's mother and baby home as a child until she was 4 years old. Sally, you're very welcome to the programme. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You met the new Minister for Children, Charlie Flanagan, this week about the inquiry into mother and baby homes, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But first, the funeral has just taken place a little earlier today of Gerry Conlon, a man who was a friend of yours and who you knew very well. And I know you've been reflecting on his life on RTE earlier this week, but I was interested to see that you say the demon of injustice never left him. And despite the fact that his family paid such warm tributes to him today and said that he was the life and soul of their family in many ways, he had very difficult issues to deal with for the remainder of his life after his release from prison.
Yes, he most certainly did. I mean, I think what I want to say first of all is Gerry's at peace now, and I think we're all pleased for that. The demon of his injustice, it is a fact that Gerry, it never left him. This 15 years of wrongful imprisonment never left Gerry, the pain and the kind of long-term suffering that Gerry endured as a consequence of that 15 years of wrongful imprisonment and the nature of his conviction as well. But Gerry leaves a legacy now, and I think, what we want to talk about, I suppose, really is looking to the future. And, the legacy for me that Gerry leaves is you need to impress upon all of us to, stand up with a bit more conviction for a just and fair society, and stand up for justice.
And that's what he did in many instances where he perceived that an injustice was happening. He was quite prepared to stand up and be counted.
Yes, and the other lasting impression that Gerry has left is his ability, despite his own suffering, to commit, and he committed the entire second half of his life after he got out of prison. He committed it to the struggle for justice and to helping others. Not just in Ireland and the UK. Gerry even went to death row and met death row prisoners. Himself and Paddy Hill persuaded a university in Philadelphia to get its final year law students involved and engaged in death row prisoners who were fighting miscarriage of justice cases. Gerry went absolutely everywhere. He was a highly principled man who committed his life to those who struggled. And I was thinking just this week when I was at the President of Ireland's ethics event, where he asks us to urgently look and find a distinctive and engaged and moral voice. You know, I believe that the President's speech was so timely, his speech on ethics, asking us to enter into a kind of a collective assessment of our own current values. And I think we need to do that. And we do really need to look at what it is we're doing or not doing in the cause of human rights and in the cause of justice.
Do you think that we're lacking?
Pardon?
Do you think that we're lacking in that regard?
Yes. I mean, there are outstanding individuals like Gareth Pearce, Gerry's lawyer, who was with him when he died.
She spoke at his funeral today.
She devoted her whole life to and then there are individuals in Ireland, Michael Farrell, for example, the lawyer in Dublin, who's devoted his whole life to human rights. And I'd even include there Christy Moore. Every concert on every stage raised the issues of injustice. And I just feel we need, to think a bit more deeply about what it is we contribute to making life better. And I would encourage young lawyers, before they go off and make loads of money, maybe they might think of dedicating a year of their life and get involved in the President's ethics ethics initiatives. Maybe get involved in dedicating their first year as lawyers to in cases of injustice.
Just on that theme of injustice, and we know that Gerry Conlon, the Guildford Four, did have an apology from the British government, but I think people are under the impression, aren't they, or would you agree, that Gerry Conlon and the other members of the Guildford Four, indeed the Birmingham Six, got huge amounts of money in compensation. That's not the case, though, is it?
No, it most definitely isn't the case, and I'm glad that you raise it, because it is an illusion that people have. What actually happened in reality, first of all, was that it took years for their compensation claims to be resolved. It wasn't that they got out and within the year they were, you know, massively compensated, set up in a home, able to relive their lives again. Quite the contrary. Their compensation was given to them piecemeal over a very long period of time. I know in the case of the Birmingham Six, it took something like 5 to 6 years. In the case of Gerry and the other Guildford people, first of all, they got peanuts, and it dragged out over a very long period of time. And also, none of these men and the women involved, as Judith Ward I would include there, none of them were really equipped to deal with the complexities of making a claim for compensation for wrongful conviction for a massive miscarriage of justice. They were, you know, from the moment of their release, they were basically thrown on the scrap heap. Without the help of their families and without the help of Gareth Pearce and close friends, they wouldn't have even sustained themselves, even as they were. But their compensation was piecemeal, very, very badly done, and quite cruel as well. Like, I remember Billy Power telling me it was really hard to kind of settle your life when you don't know what's happening. They also had to fight. Some of the Birmingham Six guys were coming up to pensionable age, and I remember discovering that the 16 years they were in prison, they were advised that no, you're not getting, you didn't pay insurance stamps, so therefore you won't be eligible for a pension for this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
We had to fight. I took 3 or 4 years, I think, a few Home Secretaries, and the commitment of Chris Mullen, that wonderful MP who initiated many of the revelations on the Birmingham Six wrongful conviction. We fought to get the restoration of their pension rights, but it took a very long time. So,
well, as you said,
know, all of that took its toll.
I'm sure it did.
Particularly on people like Gerry.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said at the start, he is at peace now, and may he rest in peace.
Mm.
Sally, we want to move on and talk about another issue you were involved in during the week. That was your meeting, your first meeting with the Minister for Children, Charlie Flanagan, about the statutory inquiry into mother and baby homes. Now, first of all, tell us what your concerns were. What did you bring to the table when you met Charlie Flanagan?
Well, the first thing I brought really, first of all, can I say that it was a really positive meeting, and I was really delighted to actually meet Charlie Flanagan, and also for his prompt response to my request. I appreciate it, because I'm very much aware several people and several groups have also put in requests to him. But what I raised with him, first of all, I can't remember in the order, but the priorities for me was, first of all, the sensitivity of the Commission for Investigation. I felt it was really, really important that the feelings and the kind of experiences of the women involved, both the mothers who gave birth, and then the children, people like myself, who were the children of mothers in mother and baby homes. It was important that as this commission, it's a very complex commission of investigation, as it. You know, goes about its business, that there isn't kind of daily bulletins of sensational, news stories, because we're dealing here with real people. We're dealing with people in advanced age in many cases. So I raised that. I also raised the... I was very pleased that Bethany Holmes were going to be included in this commission of investigation. I think that was really important. They've been... Derek Leinster, who's led that campaign, have been knocking on the door for justice for about 14 years. It was a grave error that they were excluded from the first redress scheme. And I said to the Minister, I hope that would be prioritised.
But are you concerned at all, because we have the inclusion of the Bethany Homes, and there will be other issues, and the mother and baby homes, the entire issue stretches over so many decades, Sally, that this could just be a huge inquiry, an endless inquiry, if you like.
Yeah, I think the Bethany Homes, you're right to point that out, and the Bethany Homes people are saying, what's it got to do with mother and Baby Holmes. But I think that, I don't want to go to the whole case of Bethany Holmes, but I think if people read up on it and read the reasons for, you know, why it's right to include them. In terms of the wider investigation, yes, it is going to be incredibly complex. And, you know, who knows what will end up being included. I thought the minister was probably a little ambitious in hoping in getting even the scope of what they're going to investigate to the cabinet by June 30th. And I think what you might end up with is, you know, the basis of any statutory powers on the basis of a kind of an interim report rather than a report of any substance. Because, it's, you know, we can't rush this. I think as well that the scale of it, we are going to expose ourselves to those three decades of the 40s, 50s, 30s, 40s and 50s, if you like, when most of this this tragedy happened. The minister did tell me that he had already set up an interdepartmental committee involving about 8 government departments.
That's right, to decide on the terms of reference.
But I'd like to see him perhaps, I mean, I know that he wants to be inclusive in terms of individuals making submissions, but there are other bodies out there that I'd like to see invited to make submissions, like the National Women's Council of Ireland, like Amnesty International. And then there's the groups over here, particularly the group I head up myself, the Irish Women Survivors Group. We all have probably some important evidence and information that we would like the opportunity to make submissions on. But it is a very, you know, this minister was appointed one day and the following day he got this huge, big task. And, you know, he has my support and I'm sure people will want to, you know, see it succeed. But it is very, very big and very, very complex.
And I know, Sally, you deal with these women on a daily basis. Mm. And I know that many of the women that you're dealing with through the Irish Women Survivors Group want to talk about it and want to see justice being done and so on. But there are some, surely, who just don't want to see this discussed at all.
Well, I mean, that hence my you know, saying to the minister about the sensitivity. I mean, one of the, like just this week, Just this week, a woman said to me, quite an elderly woman, over 80, she had a child. She never told anyone. She never told her husband. She never told her children. They don't know they have a sister. She lives in dread of what might happen if legislation was taken as far as giving full rights to adopted children, for example. She lives in dread of her daughter knocking on her door. Now, you know, that's one side of it, and absolutely right that the daughter has rights too. But we have to treat it very, very carefully. We have to be very careful about the legislation that we consider here. Not every adoption, by the way, in my view, was a bad adoption. And the word forced adoptions, I would also suggest that we use the term informal adoptions as well, because the Adoption Act itself didn't come into 1952. A lot of these, you know, what have been described as illegal adoptions were actually informal, very cruel, very callous, awful arrangements, but they weren't adoptions as such. So I mean, I'm not an expert. I'm only speaking about my own experience. My own brother, for example, was adopted, inverted commas, before 1952. Actually, you know, in his case, it was a very happy adoption. But there again, it wasn't legalised or regularised, if you like, until post-day 1952. So there's, again, Claire, an awful lot of complexities about this. I keep saying that, but there is.
Well, look, Sally, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to take our call today. Sally Mulready there in London, who met Minister for Children, Charlie Flanagan, about the upcoming Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes. You're listening to Saturday with Claire Byrne. I'd like to welcome and introduce you to our panel, Minister of State of the Department of the Environment and Energy, Fergus O'Dowd. We have Senator Dara O'Brien with us, Fianna Fáil leader in the Shannon, Mary Minahan, who's political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Gerard Howland, who's public affairs consultant and Irish Examiner columnist. And we'll talk to you all in just a moment. But first, we want to go to our Europe correspondent, Paul Cunningham, who joins us. Paul, Jean-Claude Juncker was elected as EU Commission President yesterday after all of that kerfuffle when the British Prime Minister was dead set against his election and so on, but he failed to win support for his position. So what will be the fallout from all of this?
Well, I think the main thing to look at is David Cameron himself. I mean, when he was speaking after the decision was made, he really ratcheted up the language. He spoke about Britain now being in a war, and I have a statement in front of me, and it gives you certainly a flavour of it. He sort of says, if you're deadly serious about reform and you want change as I am, you won't back down. My colleagues at the Council know I am deadly serious about EU reform. He went on, this is going to be a long, tough fight, and sometimes you have to be ready to lose a battle to win a war. He says Britain is going to work with intensity and grit to reform the EU. So you get a flavour of just how combative he was. And yet, if you look at the papers today, he's sort of getting it in the neck. The Daily Mail has described it as a humiliation. Labour leader Ed Miliband has said instead of building alliances, he burns them and Britain loses out. And the German newspaper Bild reacted with derision and equated Cameron with Wayne Rooney, saying he lines up, he loses, he goes home.
I just wonder how seriously everybody is taking him. I mean, amongst the other 27 leaders, because Enda Kenny in his press conference said, you know, it was pretty nice atmosphere. It wasn't, it wasn't as fractious as perhaps we might have thought it would have been. So are the other leaders aware that he's playing very much to his home audience and that things will carry on as usual on a European level?
I think so. I think everyone knew that Mr. Cameron was going to lose, but he was coming in talking up his battle, which he was never going to win. I mean, the process has been clear for over a year. We knew that the EPP had a candidate. The decision was taken in Dublin and in March. The debates between Mr. Juncker and the President of the European Parliament were carried live on German television. I mean, this has been a foregone conclusion. So I think they're keenly aware that David Cameron has got a battle. He's got an election coming up next year. He's got a referendum on EU membership coming up by the latest 2017. And so if you look at the comments from the leaders, they seem to be not getting irritated at the language Mr. Cameron was using, but offering him a way out. And Angela Merkel was saying that she was ready to address British concerns. And the Swedish Prime Minister Reinfeldt was talking that ever closer European Union is not going to be the best for all. And that's never been stated before in an EU council. So Mr. Cameron was actually getting support, even though he was effectively kicking EU leaders once he got outside the meeting.
So we could be looking at a twin-track Europe then, when many of the member states cozy up together in a closer union and Britain decides to stay outside of that.
Well, that's going to be the key thing. What type of measures are David Cameron going to be able to bring back? Can he say that, for example, he is going to restore power over home affairs and justice matters and bring that back to Parliament? Is he going to have enough to be able to allow the British people to vote in a referendum saying, OK, significant reforms happened. We believe there is a two-track approach. We're on the outside. That's where we want to be. Or are they going to say no? And the opinion polls would suggest that he's going to need to get something substantial. Otherwise, they're going to vote to leave the European Union. And to secure something of substance like that means probably unpicking treaties. So how far are EU leaders prepared to go? It's still unclear. It's a major question.
And Paul, we're just about to discuss here in studio who Ireland's next commissioner will be. There is a call from the existing commissioner, Morgan Quinn, for the appointment to be made pretty quickly in order to get a good portfolio. What portfolio do you think is potentially on offer for the new Irish commissioner?
Well, speculation is everything. Every possible commission job is being touted. But I think what happens first is the candidate. And Mr. Juncker is going to look at the candidate and their stature and their ability on that basis, then allocate a portfolio to them. So I think that is the big thing. I think the commissioner is right when she says an early decision makes it easier for the commission president to consider the matter. But the first things first, who are they going to send over?
Will there be any influence from Jean-Claude Juncker on who the candidate might be? do you think?
Well, Jean-Claude Juncker's people are talking that he wants serious politicians to come over to do a serious job, given the challenges that the European Union faces. That's what they want to see. They want to see a serious candidate. Maybe beauty's in the eye of the beholder. We have to wait to see who Mr. Kenny believes is a serious politician.
Absolutely. Well, look, we'll get our politicians and commentators to discuss all of that around the table. But in the meanwhile, thank you very much, Paul Cunningham, for joining us on that issue today. It's fascinating. Who is going to be the new commissioner to Europe? I suppose we'll start with you, Minister, because we know that Phil Hogan's name was sort of a shoe-in for a long time. Now things seem to be changing as the decision becomes a little more imminent. Eamon Gilmore would quite like the job. I see Mairead McGuinness, also Fine Gael, of course, one paper at least saying that perhaps she might be an option. What do you reckon?
I think the most important thing of all is that we will have the right portfolio and that we have the person to match that portfolio. And clearly it's a matter for the government.
What's the right portfolio then? Let's start with that.
Well, in terms of our economy, where can we have the most influence? Where is our economic future in job creation? In agriculture, in the digital future, in tech, in energy, they're all
it's
huge.
Covering a lot of ground there.
Yes,
but
yes, absolutely, they are. No, I'm just saying, like, they're critical to our economy, and clearly, obviously, Phil Hogan, I believe, would make an excellent first-class commissioner, and I believe he's got an awful lot of experience.
So, but speculation around Mairead McGuinness then is
I think Mairead is also a very competent and qualified person, but it's a matter for the government. But I'd be happy whatever decision they make.
But you'd be particularly happy if it's Phil Hogan.
I know Phil very well, I'll put it to that way.
Okay.
But it's a matter entirely for the government.
What about Eamon Gilmore then?
Well, Eamon Gilmore has served his country extremely well. He's been an excellent leader of the Labour Party and a foreign minister, and he would also make a very good commissioner. I have no doubt about that.
So you would welcome his appointment as well?
Look, it's a matter for...
I know you're trying to tread a fine line here, but it'd be just...
No, I'd be very clear, obviously. Like, it's a matter for the government to decide, and clearly...
But your preference
is for Phil. Obviously, clearly, yes, for Phil. That's my personal preference, of course.
Mary, can I talk to you about this, just in terms of the speculation around Leinster House and what's been happening? Is Eamon Gilmore a serious contender at this point?
Well, Phil Hogan has been walking around Leinster House for months now like a man whose bags are packed. You know, he's been pretty relaxed. I was up at the Ireland-France Chamber of Commerce, though, early one morning during the week, and Eamon Gilmore was addressing that. And I asked him, kind of in a light-hearted way, you know, what do you say when your European counterparts say to you you'd make a great commissioner? And he smiled, and much to my surprise, he said, I think they're right. So I don't doubt for a minute that he wants the job. And I do find persuasive that Mr. Gilmore might get what some people would consider a better post because of his contacts and his frequent visits abroad. I think there's the argument that he's paid a very high both personal and political price as a result of the compromises that he's put his party through to keep the coalition together. I also can see the point that the Taoiseach Enda Kenny might like to keep Phil Hogan at home, given the talk of general elections maybe in the air. But I suppose what it comes down to is, who is Mr. Kenny prepared to disappoint? He may be kind of tribal about it. I think that it would probably, if Labour pushed this, it would involve a big concession for them at home. I think it's a balancing act whether or not they think it's worth that. I think perhaps if Mr. Gilmore had stayed on and not retired from the Labour leadership so quickly, he might be in a stronger position now. But it also comes down to whether or not a deal was done. I know there's debate between the two coalition partners on that, with Labour saying no deal was done and they believe that they can still get hold of this. But I think at the moment Phil Hogan can still be fairly confident.
What about Mairead McGuinness then?
Mairead McGuinness, I've heard weighing in on the Brian Crowley issue quite a lot recently, which I thought was interesting, because there used to be that old political protocol where one party would never really engage in the internal matters of another party. But that seems to have gone now, and I think that certainly indicates her willingness to come on programmes, come on the radio and television and so on this matter, indicates that she's certainly very interested and she's really talking up her contribution to agriculture and so on. Now, I think it would be a huge coup of Ireland was to score the agriculture portfolio. Don't get me wrong, I think we should always be ambitious, but I think even Phil Hogan himself would be surprised if Ireland was to secure that particularly important portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Dara, we're going to talk about Fianna Fáil and Brian Crowley in just a minute, but what do you make of what's happening in the lead up to this appointment?
Well,
who should get it?
It's kind of, well, who should get it, as Fergus said, it's a matter for the Taoiseach. But what's really interesting is the EU Commissioner job now and the appointment has been tied up in the cabinet reshuffle, in the Labour leadership. You're going to have some type of renegotiation of the programme for government after the local election performance, particularly by Labour, and a poor performance as well by Fine Gael and the cabinet reshuffle. So what you get a sense of with this appointment is it's more than just who's going to be our EU commissioner. This is tied up on the cabinet reshuffle, who's going to be the next Labour leader, how can Labour reassert themselves in government? Because Gilmore's name had not only come up over the last few weeks, I'd heard that a few months ago that it had been mentioned, you know, and when things didn't look so good for Labour. And this is the kind of worrying thing that, you know, it might have been a soft landing for him, so there wouldn't have to be a leadership challenge, send him off to Europe. But I'm wondering is, you know, we also hear this commentary in relation to Phil Hogan that, now it is commentary, but that, you know, we were sending Phil off because he did it in environment. He made a lot of tough decisions. He's most unpopular. The people don't like him, so send him off to Europe. So, but is that what we really want from our commissioners? And is that the criteria that we should be applying in relation to selecting a commissioner on the basis that he made a lot of tough calls on water, he made a good few mistakes as well, he's unpopular, so send him to Europe?
It's always and a then, political decision,
no, I know,
no doubt,
I understand,
isn't it?
No, but look at the context of when it's being made. Fergus is right in what he's saying, and Mary as well, that it's very important that we get as good a portfolio as possible. But the thing has to be that we put the best person in place to do that. And that is a political decision, but it's all tied up in trying to stabilise the government now at this stage, because there is a sense as well there that the government could be getting towards its last legs now at this stage. So it's about who's going to move into which portfolios in cabinet, and then who's going to get the commissionership. If Gilmore gets the commissionership, and I wouldn't agree with Fergus on that. I don't think he's been a fantastic Minister for Foreign Affairs at all, I would put it to you, nor has he been a particularly good leader of the Labour Party, I would put it to you, particularly over the last couple of years. But I think it's about looking at who's going to, in what fashion, what Labour concessions, what concessions would Fine Gael get from Labour should Labour get the commissionership? I'd say the favourite at the moment is obviously Minister Hogan, because everyone has thought that was a fait accompli, it was a done deal.
Isn't it interesting, though, what Paul Cunningham was saying, that Jean-Claude Juncker will be looking at this candidate and going, do I know this person? Mm. Are they of a serious calibre here?
Yeah.
And that will inform the portfolio that this person gets. So would it not flow into that if you're looking at this from his point of view, he would very likely know Mairead McGuinness very well?
Well, it's quite possible. I think that would further complicate things for the Taoiseach. I think he's a difficult enough job now of trying to keep Labour off the pitch, let alone having Mairead McGuinness coming into the frame. Yeah, it would. But I think, obviously, with Juncker being in the EPP, there would be context there already. I'm sure the Taoiseach, I would be very surprised if the Taoiseach hasn't discussed it, you know, informally already.
With him?
Absolutely. You know, I would think a lot of that is done. But it's going to be very interesting. You see, will it be done before the 4th of July, before the Labour leadership election? How soon will the reshuffle be done? You know, and is it being delayed now to wait for the reshuffle? And your point at the very beginning is correct, Claire, that a lot of people are saying it's important that we get our person onto the pitch very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But for political reasons, are we going to hang on for a couple of weeks to wait to see what the composition of the new cabinet is?
Okay.
I think your analysis, I don't accept at all. I think the fact is this, that what is making the commissionership available is the fact that there has to be a change now. And as you said yourself, the key issue is to get our commissioner out there as quickly as possible with the best job that they can do. So all the rest of your analysis with respect to I would utterly and absolutely reject.
I'd expect
the question. The question you raise about the fact that this government is dealing with the economy, this government is committed to reducing our deficit to 3%. This government is working, and we're working together, and we are creating jobs.
Okay.
When you were in power, you were losing 5,000 jobs a month.
We're getting off the point here now.
But he was getting off the point too.
Okay.
I just want to make that very strong.
I want to hear from Gerard Hallin, who we haven't heard from yet. Gerard, just going back to the point that Dara was making, that all of this now, the appointment of the EU commissioner, the selection of the person, which will ultimately impact the portfolio that we get, is wrapped up in politics, in local, in Irish politics, and that's a mistake.
Well, it's wrapped up in Irish politics, and it's a smaller piece on a much bigger chessboard than our conversation might indicate. But the bigger chessboard, again, is in Europe. And immediately on Juncker's appointment, the game in Europe moved on to the discussion around the replacement for Herman Van Rompuy as president of the council. That's the game that's on now. In those circumstances, it cannot be ruled out that Enda Kenny might not be asked. It's unlikely, but it's a possibility, and that would throw everything up in the air in terms of domestic politics. Assuming that does not happen, and that unlike Mr. Gilmore, who repeatedly said he had no interest whatsoever in becoming European Commissioner and was determined in all circumstances to lead the Labour Party on into the next election, if Labour were to push Eamon Gilmore's case, they could only do so in circumstances where they would have to hand over a shed load of political capital in return for the favour to their coalition partners.
And would that be worth it for the party?
It would be insane. In circumstances where it's a minute to midnight to oblivion for them politically, not to concentrate wholly on their domestic issues, to get the right ministers in the right portfolios out of this reshuffle, to get the right decisions for them in Budget 2015 in October, and to be distracted less to spend political capital on promoting Eamon Gilmore's case for European Commissioner just simply would not make any sense at all. It would be simply crazy.
So Phil Hogan, you reckon?
Well, Phil Hogan seems to be the Fine Gael preferred. And I have no doubt that when Enda Kenny hosted the European, the EPP, the Christian Democrat Conference in Dublin, that anointed Jean-Claude Juncker as their candidate, all of these things count in terms of political connectivity. You know, going back to 2004, Ireland had the presidency. Barroso emerged as president of the commission under those circumstances. Charlie McCreevy went to Brussels to get a very senior portfolio. You can say it was coincidence. I rather doubt it. The last time round, very significant pressure was brought to bear by President Barroso on then Taoiseach Cowan to appoint a woman because he had to present a gender-balanced commission to the European Parliament, without which his commission would have been in great trouble. Hence Maura Geoghegan Quinn, who had the added advantage of not being a member of the Dáil, which was untenable for Brian Cowan in this numbers he had in the Dáil at that time. All of these things come into play. Taoiseach does have the numbers to appoint one of his own. I'd be surprised if it's not Phil Hogan.
If he doesn't, okay. Let's talk about the other European issue which dominated the headlines today. Mary, you made reference to Brian Crowley a couple of moments ago and his decision to leave the ALDE group and join the Eurosceptic grouping. Do people care?
I think people care because domestically what it indicates is a bigger problem for Fianna Fáil. Fianna Fáil has always been extremely proud of its European tradition and how it's guided the country through various European referendums and so on. But this departure from the norm for Fianna Fáil has been a big shock to the party and another blow, I think, to Micheál Martin. And, you know, I think it throws light on the fact that Fianna Fáil is now a small party, and while I totally acknowledge that Micheál Martin has once again made it the largest local authority party, but I'm talking about in terms of its Dáil representation, it's a small party that still thinks like a big party. It still has these legacy issues, and you know, Micheál Martin is left playing this kind of game of political whack-a-mole, trying to, you know, beat down these problems that keep arising in the form of people like Brian Crowley, Eamon O'Queeve, Mary Hanafin, even the Niall Collins situation there last week. And I think it's quite difficult for him because he's quite a sort of a consensual leader, and he finds it quite hard to wield the mallet in that way, in some sense.
You draw the comparison between how Fianna Fáil is operating and how we see it operating publicly and Sinn Féin.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, look at the discipline that Sinn Féin shows. It says, that party says, that it debates and discusses every policy issue and every issue that comes up. Now, maybe it's just a coincidence that they all seem to fall into line and they all agree with what the party leader says. But
Darragh O'Brien's shaking his head.
That's what they show externally.
The real answer is here, for God's sake.
That's Micheál Martin's problem. I think he realises what the party needs to do. He was an early adapter, if you like, to the shocking result in the 2011 general election. He saw the problem. He knew what needed to be done to fix it. That was to move forward in a unified way and put old grudges to the side. But unfortunately for him, his rank and file members haven't allowed that to happen in the Dáil and Shannon.
OK, well, Dara, you respond to that then.
How you're about an, I disagree with Mary?
You're an ill-disciplined party, Fianna Fáil.
Well, look, I read Mary's article last week. It was interesting to read it because there have been issues like come up in every party. Like we, you know, go back to 2011 and you look at, you know, what a lot of commentators said at the time. It was about whether Fianna Fáil would exist at all, whether it was on the way out completely. It's been a really tough 3 years, and rightly so. The electorate made their decision on the party, which was fully respected, and we had to rebuild. In a relatively short space of time, Mary, and a lot of media always reference Sinn Féin, and this kind of amused me to some degree, because if you look at the electoral performance in the first national election that we've had since 2011, like we're the largest party in local government, with a vote of over 26%. Sinn Féin's vote is at 15%. Sinn Féin were polling and continually poll in the high 20s, you know, and that type of thing. But what I'll get back to the point specifically, it's been a tough 3 years, but it's been a decent 3 years insofar as our rebuilding. Issues arise. Brian Crowley, we talk about the specific situation. I know Brian very well. He's a very good guy. You know, he's well-liked within my party.
Not everyone says that. They say he operates as Brian Crowley.
I'm here. Look, he has a track record within the party going back, you know, years. He's consistently succeeded in every election he's put himself forward for. He's a very good colleague. Now, Brian made a decision, and that's the crux of it. He made the decision to join the ECR. And parts of the ECR group are so contrary to what I believe in and my party believe in and our members believe in. Like we're talking about, you know, the commissioner, we're talking about, and Fergus is rightly saying about, you know, trying to get a better deal for Ireland on banking debt, the fiscal compact treaty. The True Finns, which are part of the ECR group, actively campaign against things like that.
But look, the bottom line is a man who gets over 183,000 votes in the European election, he's bigger than Fianna Fáil.
He's not bigger than Fianna Fáil. Absolutely not. You've 268 councillors elected across the country. Brian's not bigger than Fianna Fáil. But look, we're not.
Taking the decision he took, do you think he thinks he's bigger than Fianna Fáil?
No, well, you'd have to ask. I'm not evading it. I don't know, right? Because you'd have to ask him that, and I haven't spoken to him. But what I'm saying to you is that he took the decision to join a grouping that's contrary to what we believe in. So he lost the whip himself. He is still a member of Fianna Fáil. I would, if he is to leave the ECR in the future, which I hope he does, the door is absolutely open for
him. You want to see him back?
I absolutely, but I've immense regard for Brian. Of course I do. But I don't want to see, that decision had to be made. And it was made by the parliamentary party, by the way, not by the party leader. I was at the meeting. The parliamentary party decides on that, and that decision was made earlier on this week. But of course I'd like to see Brian back, but we cannot have anything to do with the ECR group.
Okay.
And it's as simple as that.
On the wider issue of these problems, and Mary mentioned, you know, Éamon O'Caoimh, yeah, I think was probably the first one after 2011 that caused a problem. Then you had more recently Mary Hanlon. Just seems to be a lot of dirty linen hanging out, you know?
What, Claire, let's be straight about it. It's in 3.5 years, effectively, Mary's mentioned 4 issues. I'd love to know a party. I could mention 4 or 10 issues that Sinn Féin have had to deal with, that Fine Gael have had to deal with, that Labour have had to deal with. You know, it's not plain sailing. You know, like these are the type of things. You've got 4 specific issues.
Why do you think everybody asks once something like this happens? Is there a question mark over Micheál Martin's leadership? Why are people asking that question?
I think, well, some people might be a bit fixated on it. Okay, but you know, when you're out and about, and you know, out in our areas and talking to people. People, the normal, you know, people out in the streets aren't asking that, but there's certain elements of the media, you know, they're asking questions, and that's their job, is to ask the question. No issue with that. But all I would just say is to balance it on the basis of the progress that has been made. He's a ferociously hard worker, is Micheál. I don't think anyone would have put the energy that he put in, both at the very start in the Shannon election, on the Shannon referendum, on the local elections, on by-election performances that we've had, which have been very decent. Any electoral performance that he's had as leader has been very good. Look, we're not a party like Sinn Féin that want to shut down any dissent or any discussion. And Mary's saying, you know, it's kind of amazing that all the Sinn Féin guys and girls go out and say exactly the same thing. They do, because they're told to. Right. But I would rather have a party that discusses things, that allows people to have different views And that, yes, the odd time that comes out in public, but so what?
Okay, you know? All right. And if Sinn Féin were here, I'm sure they'd disagree with me
completely.
Fergus, you wanted to
come in? Can I say to the public that voted for Brian must feel very let down, because 2 weeks after they vote for somebody who belongs to a party that is pro-Europe and in favour of all the good things, and they're mainly pro-European people who went out and voted, find that he's gone to a right-wing Eurosceptic party. And I think the other point I would say, that Fianna Fáil had enough votes to win two seats. Not just one, two seats in that constituency. Now they've ended up with absolutely none.
Well, that's the problem with failure. Brian. It was outlined in this studio before the election that he's a great vote getter, but he doesn't share those votes with the other candidate.
Whatever the issues were, whatever personal issues he had, for it all to reach a crisis 2 weeks after the election, obviously meant that there were issues there before the election and weren't there.
But every party has its problems, Fergus.
Yeah, but I'm trying to respond to the question as to the leadership of Micheál Martin, that he isn't decisive, that he didn't deal with these issues, and that he had Mary Hanifin. He also had the spokesman of Justice Niall Collins recently, who took the high moral ground on all the issues, wrote a letter pleading with a judge for somebody who had committed a very serious offence. So I think that Fianna Fáil shows the disunity. It is divided, and I think that the issue in relation to your former deputy leader, Eamon O'Queeve, he lost his position. Mm-hmm. You also didn't agree as a party on that referendum on protecting the right to life of the mother.
The party
divided on that issue and did not follow Micheál Martin.
Fergus, that's
a fact.
Okay, look, I don't want to be talking over you, but what was asked for at the time, and what your party had asked for on the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill, and what you'd promised, was something completely contrary to what you did. Our party leader gave a free vote. And
but
I don't
party
think
and voted and, against and, his and recommendation. As part that was
of,
the point.
As part of when you guys stood for election, you talked about reforming Irish politics, a whole reform agenda, relaxing the whip, not shutting down debates, like guillotines on bills, and you've actually used it more than any previous government.
Your party voted against its own leader recommendation on the critical issue of the right to life. It was a free vote, Fergus.
Gerard Hanlon, I want to come to you on this, because your view would be particularly interesting, because you used to advise, of course, Bertie Ahern. So in terms of a leader and how he's operating and how he has handled this and other issues within the party, do you think those questions are valid, you know, that we ask all of the time something like this comes up? Is Micheál Martin a strong leader? Is he a weak leader? Should he be there at all? Should he be replaced?
Well, of course the questions are valid. But a bit of context. And the context is that in all the years I was there, I never, ever remember a time when there wasn't some kerfuffle around somebody going on morning, noon and night, and trying to find out what they were at.
But you know what the key difference is? We didn't hear about it.
Well, you did. Sorry, Claire. You did hear about it. Those issues were repeatedly widely covered in the media. The key difference, in my opinion, is between TDs, senators and MEPs and a party in government. You're talking about a big ship with nearly 100 people, and it could be sort of portrayed as being something on the sidelines, at the edges. In a much smaller party, in post-traumatic syndrome phase still, it's much more central and it looks so much bigger.
The context is
hugely different. In relation to Micheál, I mean, his credits are Fianna Fáil has survived. He has survived. It's the largest party in local government. European elections, obviously, not nearly as successful. No. And now what bit of shine there might have been on it is completely gone. But I'm perplexed with Brian Crowley. Very pleasant guy, lot of charisma, lot of ability, 5 stunningly successful elections to the European Parliament. But what's it all for? And the reason I did a novel for my Leaving Cert, Silas Marner, and Silas's great pleasure in life was counting his gold at night and seeing the glint of it in the dark. And this seems to be sort of Brian's currency, that he has all these huge piles of votes that because of his popularity and his ability, he repeatedly accrues. But 5 times later in the European Parliament, there's a question, apart from being popular, apart from going on, apart from being there, what's it for? You know, dull politicians.
What do you mean, what's it for? Do you mean what's he going to do with this level of popularity?
And political currency, that is that astonishingly high level of vote. Ultimately, it's fair to ask somebody in politics, particularly somebody in politics for a very long time, what are you there for? What's it for? Fergus O'Dowd in government, or Dara O'Brien, who was in the government party and is going to contest, they have difficult decisions to make all the time.
Maybe there's nothing to see here apart apart from somebody who's interested in
public
representation.
Well, maybe there is just an enormous vacuity that is resting behind sort of a miasma of popularity, and maybe that's all it is, and maybe the show is the show. But if that's it, and that's the a lifetime of politics at that extraordinarily high level with that much political currency.
What's his secret? Does anybody know Brian Crowley's secret?
Well, people who have charisma, and not having very much myself, I always ask. I'm always. But if you find out, Claire, please tell me.
We certainly will do our best. We might ask him one. You're listening to Saturday with Claire Byrne. We're about to talk about the imminent reshuffle in just a moment, but a couple of texts. Sean in Longford says the only reason that Phil Hogan is for Europe is that he won't get his seat the next time. That's a prediction and a half. Bula Boss from Micheál Martin says another listener. I'm not quite sure why, but I assume it's got something to do with our conversation a moment ago and the Brian Crowley situation. Micheál Martin's leadership of Fianna Fáil is a shambles. In 3 years in opposition, they failed to develop a policy on any of the major issues. Health, jobs, Europe, the economy. Is any wonder they're still at 20% in the polls? Marion Ryan says people don't like him. Oh, I think she's talking about Phil Hogan there, but she uses an exclamation mark. What about the magic word some people don't like him? I like Phil Hogan, and I hope that man isn't speaking for me. Who said that people don't like Phil Hogan? I'm not sure.
I think
sure.
I must have said that.
Did you say that? Strangely enough, Tara, that you said it.
I'm really sorry, okay?
All right, I just want to remind you, if you're just joining us, of our panel. We have Minister of State at the Department of Environment and Energy, Fergus O'Dowd, Senator Dara O'Brien, who's Fianna Fáil leader in the Shannon, Mary Minahan, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Gerard Hanlon, public affairs consultant and Irish Examiner columnist. And we said we're going to talk about the reshuffle because, of course, the Labour leadership will be decided by this time next week. We should have a result. And that paves the way for the Cabinet reshuffle to be announced. And there's so much speculation around all of this. And we're just going to add to it now by talking about it a little bit more. Mary, I'll come to you first for the overview on this, because if Joan Burton wins, as she is expected to, or certainly the polls are telling us, she's going to change her ministers around, one would imagine. So Rory Quinn, Pat Rabbit and Eamon Gilmore, it's expected, will be out of their portfolios. It sounds awful just to say that will be the case, but that seems to be the received wisdom. Is that fair enough?
I think it's important to bear in mind, Claire, like Labour only has 5 out of the 15 senior positions. So, really she doesn't have that much room for manoeuvre if, as you say, as expected, she does become leader. Brendan Howlin and herself presumably will be staying put. And then she's got three gifts, I suppose, and she has very much stressed the need for gender equality. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I remember her saying at a Women's Day event that she would like to see 50-50 equality at Cabinet. Now, Fine Gael to date haven't done much to help her out in that regard, with the honourable exception of Frances Fitzgerald, although I think Regina Doherty might be somebody else that might get the nod, perhaps not to the senior position, but at least up into the ranks of junior ministers. So Joan Burton could be perhaps looking at someone like Kathleen Lynch, who would be very much there on merit.
Who perhaps, is a junior minister.
Yeah, and Alan Kelly, I think, as well, would expect the nod up to seniority. And then another TBC, I suppose. I think Joan Burton could pull a surprise there, and she might go for a rank outsider, pull up a backbencher. I just don't know on that one. Then it spreads out and gets very, very interesting. I think there'll be certain people who'll stay where they are. Michael Noonan, the Minister for Finance, I think he's kind of untouchable. Charlie Flanagan, who's obviously quite new to his position, I don't think he'll be going anywhere. Francis Fitzgerald. But the ones we're all looking...
Sorry, Francis Fitzgerald is in justice, of course. Yep. Charlie Flanagan is Minister for Children.
And the ones we're all looking at now are James Riley, I suppose, in health. What will happen there?
Is that a given? I mean, we've heard so much speculation about the health portfolio. Dara Brown, you're shaking your head.
I don't think it's a given. But I think one of the things with reshuffles I was just mentioning is that everyone expects a lot to happen. And there's an expectation that there's going to be massive, changes within Cabinet. And a lot of the times, if you look back at reshuffles over successive governments, people ended up pretty disappointed by saying, well, that was a piecemeal reshuffle.
But there has to be a pretty big reshuffle.
Well, there has to be to a degree. But like, I'm surprised if Joan Burton wins. I was surprised Mary didn't mention. You would think she'd have to look at Alex White as well. You have to look at where Labour are at. Kathleen Lynch makes sense because they've no one in Cork. And they put someone in Cork. So whatever happens. But on health, I'm not sure that this reshuffle will be as broad as all that. Now, obviously, if Phil Hogan's appointed, there's the vacancy there in environment. But From what I'm hearing, people aren't certain that he's going to move the Minister for Health.
Mm-hmm. Fergus, have you any hopes of elevation
Well, I'm happy to serve in whatever capacity it will be asked. But I think what's more important is that this is actually about getting the government plan working. It is working so far. We were elected to do a job to fix the economy. We've done that. Our job now is to create more physical jobs in our economy across all phases. So what we have to do is concentrate on the delivery in terms of policy, and individuals, whoever they may be, are not important in this. It's about getting the job done and finishing it.
Because of the mechanics of this and what's happening in Labour, this will have to be a pretty major reshuffle, would you agree?
Well, that's entirely a matter, for the Taoiseach, obviously, and whoever the new leader of the Labour Party is.
And will there be a change in health, do you reckon?
Well, I think the key point is this. What are the issues that we have to address? And obviously, clearly, James Reilly has been working extremely hard in health, and he's made very significant progress. Indeed. I mean, there's every health minister for a long time has found it a very difficult portfolio, but he has managed to reduce our waiting list. And I believe...
Do you want him to stay there?
Well, I would be very happy with whoever the Taoiseach chooses to do the job.
You don't want him to stay there.
It's not telling us what you think. Yeah,
well, Pat Rabbit knows he's going because of you look at the ministers who know that they're on the way out.
It's about the public finances.
Like even the appointments that they were making this week.
It's about the policy issues.
Stuff that you said you wouldn't do, like appointing your friends and stuff like that. You know.
I'd like to know, Gerard, what you think of this. Do you think James Reilly is definitely on his way out of health?
Yes, because Fine Gael cannot have a spokesperson on this area going into the next election that is not credible to and with the people. So there is a political requirement that they find somebody that will have more credibility electorally over the next couple of months. Full stop.
And Mary, I interrupted you. You were just at the health portfolio. Was there anybody else there you wanted to...
Just on the Reilly thing, I mean, it's difficult because he's the deputy leader, you know, but I think there will be outcry on the Fine Gael backbenches if he wasn't moved. I mean, there are a lot of people who are keeping quiet for now but are really very unhappy with how he's handled certain things.
And will he be out of cabinet altogether?
Well, see, where else does he go, Claire? I mean, there is talk about maybe himself and Leo Varadkar and other GP swapping posts, but is James Reilly really interested in planes, trains and automobiles?
There must be a portfolio shuffle in this reshuffle because the Department of Defence previously attached to Justice has now been detached. The Taoiseach is holding it temporarily. Yeah. So the lineup of departments cannot be the same.
Okay, we've got to leave it there. The hour goes so quickly on these Saturdays, but thank you all very much indeed for being with us today. We're back with you at 1 o'clock next Saturday. Do enjoy the rest of your weekend. Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Roisin Boyd. The researcher was Leslie Anderson, the broadcast coordinator Louise Denver, and sound supervision this week was by Kira Murphy.